Right, good morning. We're all online and working. I'll just shove that in my pocket. Okay, so if you can bring the slides up there, that would be great. Today, we are going to talk about arguments. Not something we often talk about at church, but we all have them. I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like I am surrounded by them. Take this week, for example. It was Tuesday morning. We were walking to school. The sun was shining. The autumn leaves were looking glorious. We weren't late. Life was good. Then my middle daughter, Martha, piped up, "Let's play I Spy." Wonderful. Life couldn't get any better. So she had a go first, and then Lizzie had a go, and I guessed Lizzie's. Then I had a go, and Lizzie guessed mine. And Lizzie said, "My turn." And Martha wailed, because of course she thought we were taking it in turns, and Lizzie thought, because she'd guessed my one, now it was her turn. Bam, out of nowhere, we're having an argument. And I stopped and I said, "Girls, this is a game. It's supposed to be fun. Do we have to have an argument about this as well?" But that's so often, that is what arguments are like, isn't it? They come out of nowhere, just when you thought everything was going fine. Now, that's a trivial example, of course, and not all arguments are trivial. They can break out in a lot of different settings. In a team meeting at work, at a family gathering, Christmas evening can be a bit of a classic example, can't it? With relative strangers, even. And they can be about different things. They might be about behaviour. So-and-so is always late for meetings. You forgot my birthday. You took the parking space I was waiting for. Or they can be about topics. I don't agree with the cost-saving measures that our organisation is taking. It's about time the government did something about X, Y, or Z. How can you believe there's a God when there's so much suffering in the world? And within the church, we're not immune, are we? As Stuart has so helpfully shared with us just now. Similarly, the first church I was a member of, I remember the shock I felt at my first church meeting. People I had known for years as members of a community suddenly became so argumentative. They could fixate on an issue and wouldn't give it up, even if that meant shooting down other people's points of view. It could be really hurtful. Because we know that matters of faith are important, but when issues become more important than relationships, then something's gone wrong. Jesus taught us that the greatest commandments are to love God and to love our neighbours as ourselves. Relationships shaped by love, that's what comes first. So today we're going to get into the murky waters of arguments, what their consequences are, how to avoid them, and the better way that God calls us to. The first thing that strikes me in this passage is that there are different characters with different dispositions towards arguments. There are the opponents or false teachers who have misinterpreted aspects of the gospel, or as Paul puts it, they've departed from the truth. Two individuals get a particular mention. It's not clear whether they have formal roles as teachers in the church or not, but they're clearly having an influence. It sounds as if they're spreading their ideas around. And they're up for an argument. They're stoking it within the community. And some people do enjoy heated discussions, don't they? Maybe even some of us. Some of us do have a higher tolerance for arguments than others. And for those people, what feels like a normal discussion to them might be experienced as an argument to someone else. Then we have Timothy. And from what we know about Timothy, I don't think he loved an argument. He was raised by two godly women. We hear about his grandmother Lois and his mother Eunice in chapter 1, verse 5. And in his letter to the Philippians, Paul commends Timothy to them for his selflessness and empathy, saying, "I have no one else like him who will show genuine concern for your welfare." He's a compassionate leader. And in the two letters to Timothy, Paul encourages him not to be looked down on because he's young and not to be timid. He sounds to me like someone who doesn't enjoy conflict, who would rather avoid it, but finds himself in the rather uncomfortable position of being a church leader and trying to hold together a community where there are dissenters spreading misinformation. And then you have Paul, who I think of as a reformed arguer. He tells us in Philippians that he was a Pharisee of Pharisees, zealous for the law, a leading figure in the persecution of the early church. He was someone who was committed to a principle and would follow it through to its ultimate conclusion, no matter the cost. But Jesus changed him. And here at the end of his life, we see that transformation in this letter. And I wonder who you relate to more. Do you enjoy a discussion? Are you in your comfort zones pursuing a principle and engaging in debate, even when it gets heated? Do you like to play devil's advocate? Do you feel in the right correcting people by these means? Or are you someone who finds conflict uncomfortable or even upsetting? Do you prefer to keep quiet when you don't agree? But then maybe sometimes you feel sort of duty-bound to try and engage in an argument when someone else is really stoking it and you think it's important. Personally, I think I'm a bit of both. We're not all one thing, are we? I generally don't like conflict, but if I feel I'm not being listened to or that someone else isn't getting a fair hearing, that can really bring out the bear in me. Paul's message here is really clear. Don't get sucked into arguments. And he doesn't caveat it. There's no, unless you know more about the topic than the other person. There is no, unless the person is really annoying and it's about time someone said something. And there's no, unless it's about something really important. Paul says, don't get caught up. Full stop. No buts. The ends does not justify the means. He means it so much that he says more or less the same thing three times. And here they are. She might be able to read, but I'll tell you the verses. So in chapter 2, verse 14, he says, warn God's people before God against quarreling about words. In verse 16, he says, avoid godless chatter. And then in verse 23, he says, don't have anything to do with foolish and stupid arguments. So let's look closer at these verses to see why we shouldn't get caught up. So firstly, in verse 14, we hear that arguments ruin those who listen. Arguments have an impact on those who witness them. It might serve to confuse or unsettle someone, but it might also make them a bit more wary of the people who are arguing. I've certainly had experiences of witnessing an argument between others and feeling a little bit more on my guard with those that were involved afterwards. And this is not good for relationships, and it's not good for our witness. In chapter 2, verse 24, have I changed side? I don't think I have. There we go. We read, the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but must be kind to everyone, able to teach, not resentful. Now, Tom Wright translates this not resentful as able to bear evil without resentment. While the New Living Translation is even more specific, saying, be patient with difficult people. The point is not simply having a non-resentful character without it being tested. It means even when provoked or wronged, the Lord's servant is patient and doesn't fall into resentfulness. Let's remember whose example we follow. Jesus, who we read prophesied about in Isaiah 53, he was oppressed and afflicted. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter. He was cut off from the land of the living, even though it was completely unjust. He'd committed no violence, he deceived no one. And in the face of this treatment, what did he do? He did not open his mouth. Now, what example does it set if, as people of faith, we are quarrelsome? It might just give someone grounds to dismiss not just us as people, but the faith that we profess as inauthentic, not credible. Arguments ruin those who listen. Secondly, in verse 16, we're told that those who indulge in godless chatter will become more and more ungodly. Arguments, and more broadly, the way we talk to each other, doesn't just affect others. It has an impact on our own characters, doesn't it? The way we speak and act creates thoughts of patterns and patterns of thought and behavior that makes us more like Jesus or less like him. Being kind to everyone, not just easy people. Being able to bear evil without resentment. These practices make us more like Jesus. But if we find ourselves in a pattern of getting caught up in arguments, being the voice of dissent and division, then this will start to show in our own characters. And thirdly, in verse 23, Paul urges, don't have anything to do with foolish and stupid arguments, because you know they produce quarrels. The point here is that arguments don't even work. They don't convince the other person that you were right and they were wrong. Instead, they just tend to cement people in the opinions they held in the first place. They produce quarrels. They escalate. They turn disagreement into divisions. Now, differences in opinion aren't a problem. Diversity, difference in interpretation, those are all normal parts of living in a community. And in this church, we're very diverse. We have different opinions about a lot of things, including even different interpretations of the Bible sometimes. And that's okay, because what unites us, our faith in the gospel that Paul taught, that Jesus was the Son of David who rose from the dead, that's more powerful than any difference in doctrine or interpretation. But when we enter into arguments, we let disagreements turn into something bigger, into something destructive, into divisions. Now, you might be thinking, this is all very nice, Rachel, but isn't it a bit naive? I mean, surely there are discussions we need to have and situations where we need to challenge other people. And sure, discussing things is good when that discussion is centered on listening and truly trying to understand the other person, just like the example that Stuart gave us earlier. But it only takes a second for a note of argument to slip into a healthy discussion. And you know, in the realm of ideas, I think there are fewer situations where we need to challenge than we might think. Because if someone is not ready to hear it, any attempt at correction will make no difference at all. We can begin with listening and with gentleness, but we cannot change someone's mind. That is something that's up to God and up to them. And Paul goes on to say this in chapter 2, verses 25 to 26. He says, opponents must be gently instructed in the hope that God will grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth, and that they will come to their senses and escape from the trap of the devil. I think sometimes it's easy for us to pick up on the word instructed and to lose sight of the gently. Gentleness, that underrated, under-discussed fruit of the Spirit. Our approach to others, even those openly disagreeing with us, even those difficult people, should above all be gentle. And it is God who might grant repentance, not our clever words or our timely interventions. God's voice in a heart that is receptive to hear it. Because repentance means turning around. Coming to one's senses is an act of choice, and these shifts can't be forced. They're choices that a person can only make for themselves with God's help. Now, look, I know it can be uncomfortable for us to let folly go uncorrected. And maybe we're worried, like it says in chapter 2, verse 17, that false ideas will spread like gangrene. But this passage is clear that letting it go is often the least bad option. And we have two reassurances. In chapter 2, verse 19, we're reminded that God's solid foundation stands firm. God's ways aren't forceful, but that doesn't mean that they're weak. Jesus says the person who hears his words and puts them into practice will be like a person who builds their house on a rock, and they will not be swayed by the storms that come. God's truth will endure. And then in chapter 3, we have a rather bleak description of terrible times that are to come, where people will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient, ungrateful, unholy, without love, and so it goes on. And such people will try to worm their ways into the homes of vulnerable people and lead them astray. But Paul simply concludes in verse 9, they will not get very far. He doesn't say you must stop these people. He says they won't get very far. Their folly will be clear to everyone. Now, when I was about 19, I worked part-time in a pub, and I got to know the locals quite well, and there was a particular chap who took quite a shine to me, and we would often chat in between serving. But as the evening went on, and as the pints went down, he would get argumentative with me. He knew I was a Christian, and he would start hounding me. Do you really think there's a God? How can there be a God? Look around you. There's no God. And he would make his case, and he'd try and goad me. And quite apart from the fact that I was at work, I could see that any argument would be fruitless anyway. I wouldn't change his mind, and he wasn't really asking me to. I was respectful of him, I acknowledged his point of view, but I wouldn't get pulled into a debate. On one particular night, I remember by the end of the evening, his mates were the ones telling him to leave it alone now. They actually started apologising to me and saying that I was right and their friend was wrong. Now, I never said that I was the one who was right. I didn't feel that anyone owed me an apology, but it was evident to them that their friend's antagonism wasn't making any sense. In the end, God's solid foundation will stand firm. So we need to not get sucked into arguments. That is a classic of God's kingdom, isn't it? Easy to understand, hard to do. So how do we avoid getting caught up in arguments? Well, I think that what we need is the Holy Spirit. In chapter 1 of 2 Timothy, in verse 7, Lou spoke on this a couple of weeks ago, we read, "For the Spirit God gave us does not make us timid, but gives us power, love, and self-discipline." So let's think about how power, love, and self-discipline help us to resist arguments. So first of all, power. What does this look like? Because we might think that powerful people aren't people who resist arguments. They are the kind who win them. Lawyers win cases. Politicians gain office, and so on. But we need to see power through Jesus' eyes, and it's not what we expect. Jesus was extraordinarily clear that power in his kingdom is not what we see around us. It is not lording it over others. For example, by taking charge, seeing it as our duty to correct others or put them in their place. Instead, it's taking the role of the servant. It's being reduced. It's being made humble. It's the power of knowing that we are in God and he lives in us. So we don't have to feel threatened and we don't have to prove ourselves. And if we have this security, we don't need to get caught up in other people's arguments. We can let it go. Secondly, love. What does love mean in this context? I think it's to do with having compassion for the agitator. Because where does argumentativeness come from? Often it comes from a place of hurt. Now, this might not be immediately obvious, but it's often there. Remember the customer in the pub that I told you about? After going through the loop of this discussion a number of times with him, one night, late in the evening, he started growing tearful. And he disclosed that he had been abused as a child in the context of a faith community. Well, no wonder he was carrying so much anger. And I've seen this time again, when someone has an axe to grind, it comes from somewhere. And even when we don't know where it's coming from, we can still extend compassion to that person. Be open to the possibility that they're harboring a hidden hurt and treat them with love, respect, gentleness, dignity. Jesus said, "Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven." Showing compassion to a person, even when their behavior is challenging, is one way of living this out. It's easier to be understanding when we know someone's backstory, but Jesus calls us to live a life of compassion first, to lead with compassion. Understanding may come, it may not. So the Spirit gives us power, love, and self-discipline. Now, I think we all need a good helping of self-discipline to help us steer clear of arguments. But what does self-discipline mean? Does it mean trying really hard? Are some people more naturally disciplined than others? Let me give you an example. On Tuesday this week, I intended to go for a run after work. I finished a 3-hour online training at 4 p.m. I looked out the window. It was grey. It was dreary. It was windy. It was raining. I did not want to go running. And since it was getting darker, I could easily construct a good rationale for not going. But I did go. Now, how did I do that? Was it my immense personal willpower? Some of you might have heard of Drs. Chris and Zand van Tulken. They talk about health a lot. They're identical twins, and they're both medical doctors. And they run a podcast called What's Up, Doc? And on this podcast, they interviewed a psychologist called Kimberly Wilson, who helped them to understand that there is no such thing as willpower. Willpower is not this magic trick inside you. Instead, your ability to stick to something is about the way you've arranged the world around you. On Tuesday, when I got up in the morning, I put on my running clothes and I wore them all day. Not only that, when I was getting dressed, I put a plaster over a blister on my toe in readiness for the run that I had planned later. So if I hadn't done it, that would have been a waste of a plaster. Also that morning, I mentioned to someone on the school run that I was planning to go for a run later. So I was a little bit accountable there. See, the self-discipline I needed was not in the moment of actually stepping out of the door and going for a run. It was earlier than that. It was in the way that I had arranged the world around me that day. So how do we need to arrange the world around ourselves to help us in the moment when we might slip into argumentativeness? Gone too far. There. The first thing we can do is notice the risk factors. And these are different for everyone. Is there a certain person or a certain situation in which you find it more difficult not to get sucked into arguments? If so, what can you do to avoid it? If you find arguments happen when you're tired or late at night, maybe the self-discipline is to go to bed, to remove yourself from the risk zone. If you find yourself getting into more arguments after having a drink or two, maybe give them a miss. If you find yourself more argumentative when you have too much on and you feel overwhelmed, then think seriously about what you can do to simplify your life. That's a big one for me. Here's a tricky one. If you find yourself more argumentative in certain online spaces or on social media, please think seriously about whether you really need to have that particular space in your life. Try fasting from it, a trial separation, if you like, and prayerfully reflect on how this has affected you and how to go forward. Now, sometimes you can't remove yourself from a situation, but what can you do to prepare yourself for it? We sometimes talk about spiritual disciplines, which are basically tools that you can practice when it's easy, so you form the habits you need when it's hard. I heard this great story about Dallas Willard. For those who haven't heard of him, he's a wonderful Christian philosopher and quite an intellectual heavyweight. On one occasion, he delivered a lecture, and in the question time afterwards, a slightly arrogant young man started really ripping into what he had just said. And Dallas just didn't really respond. Unusual. After the event, his friend asked him, "Why didn't you reply to that man? You could have easily taken him down." And Dallas said, "I was practicing the discipline of not having the last word." And maybe we can benefit from practicing not having the last word. Maybe it's that discipline of silence, of not answering back, of letting it go. Perhaps if we practice it when it's trivial, it'll be easier to resist it when it is important. Another discipline can be encouragement. Next time you find yourself in a potentially negative setting, can you set yourself the challenge of only opening your mouth in encouragement? And see how this feels in your spirit, how it affects the dynamic of the space. And my last tip of self-discipline, when avoidance is impossible and you're faced with a potential argument, remember the words that we find in James chapter 1, verse 19, which tells us, "My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry." Now, I've had that verse close to my heart for many years, probably because I need to hear it. But listening to others, real, genuine listening, actually makes it almost impossible to slip into an argument. Listening, gentleness, and prayer. If we enter into interactions with other people prayerfully, gently, and with more eagerness to listen than to speak, I think this will carry us through. Oh, we have such an opportunity here to break away from our culture, to be light in the world. Because being right, having the answers, being recognized and respected. These things feel very important right now in our culture. I work in higher education, and these things are especially exaggerated in those spaces, I can tell you, but I see it all over. But if we can resist that prideful instinct, if we can prioritize relationships over principles, if we can live as a people of gentleness and compassion, how might that transform our families, our workplaces, community settings we're part of, even our church? Because God has plans for our lives. We might not feel very significant, but we are part of his work on earth. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 20 to 21, you thought I skipped it. In a large house, there are articles not only of gold and silver, but also of wood and clay. Some are for special purposes and some for common use. Those who cleanse themselves from the latter, he's talking about wickedness, will be instruments for special purposes, made holy, useful to the master, and prepared to do any good work. Now, I brought some articles from my house here. I'll start with these. First of all, we have the classic IKEA plates and bowls. Anyone who's had a child in the last 20 years has these. They're brilliant. They're ideal for small people who are liable to announce that they're finished by throwing it on the floor daily. I love my IKEA plastic. It may not be pretty, it may not seem virtuous to anyone else, but it's really, really useful in my household. I've got my IKEA dragon cutlery. This stuff is so tough, they use it in their own cafes. Very useful, very practical. Then we have the Laura Ashley serving platter. Ooh. And, ready, the silver-plated cutlery that belonged to my nana, who was really into table service. Now, these only come out on very special occasions. Now, we are disciples of Jesus, and being disciples means that we're in the process of being changed, of becoming more like the person we follow, and none of us are finished products. We're all works in progress. And the good news is that God's house is indeed a large house. And there is room for all kinds of utensils. Each one is treasured in its way, and each one has a purpose. Yet, unlike wood or clay, or an IKEA fork that is never going to get silver plated, God is able to transform us, to make us holy, and ready to do any good work. I'd like to invite the van to come back on. And I just wanted to say that if something has resonated with you today, if you felt a connection with something that I've said, or with something Stuart said earlier, or another part of the service, if something's ringing true in your own life, I'd really like you to pay attention to that. It might be a general sense that something I've said is for you, but no clear action to take from it yet. It might be that God has convicted you of a specific protective action you need to take, something practical to help you avoid getting caught up in arguments. It might be a sense of God affirming in you that he is transforming you from a vessel of wood or clay into one of gold and silver, ready for every good work. Whatever you feel God is saying, I would love the chance to pray for you briefly to affirm it. So I'm going to ask you during our next song to take a tiny action to acknowledge God's voice in you. The band are going to lead us in a song, and as they do so, I'd like to invite you to come forward so that I can pray a simple prayer for you. And if you would like, as an affirmation of God's work in your life, I can paint a little gold or silver heart on the back of your hand. That's it. I won't ask you what you're feeling prompted about, but I would encourage you to make sure that you share that with someone you trust, ideally before you leave here today, either in person or by text, whatever feels right for you. So this is just a simple way of acknowledging that God's working in your life and acknowledging that in prayer. So I'm going to hand over to the band, and if you feel that prompting in anything I've said or anything else in this service, then please come forward during this song.